Some of us know it as tasty, tasty ribs. To others, it's a no-go based on religion, and it calls up this 1987 commercial.
Pork, the other white meat.
Yes, we are talking about pork, a meatin' that has taken a beating because of the so-called swine flu. But if you are still down with the barbecue brown, we've got some great recipes for the big cookout on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 25th. It's Memorial Day. John Hockenberry is away, hopefully having a little bit of rest and fun. And I'm Farai Chidea, along with Catherine Lanfer. Morning.
Hey, good morning, Farai. Coming up this hour, we look into North Korea claims of its second nuclear test, a war criminal who says the U.S. promised he wouldn't be prosecuted, and new research that tells us we'd be better off if we thought like babies. All this and more, but first these headlines.
Worldwide condemnation is pouring in about North Korea's announcement of a nuclear weapons test today, including that from a country that often supports the North. China is clearly stating opposition to the testing. It says Pyongyang should avoid these types of actions, return to the negotiating table. President Obama and America's top military officer have already strongly condemned the incident. The UN chief says a nuclear test would clearly violate UN rules. There are also new reports of short-range missile testing. The U.S. is checking to see if any test really took place, but there was seismic activity near North Korea's test site. The North last tested nuclear weapons in 2006. Today's reported test may be several times larger than the last.
Florida's governor says the Daytona Beach region is a disaster area. Days of rain have left waist-deep water and tens of millions of dollars in damage. The governor wants President Obama to declare a federal disaster so the area can get more cleanup money. A Volusia County spokeswoman, Michelle Coates, says she's never seen anything like it.
This has been the storm of the century for us. Particularly in East Volusia County, we haven't seen rain totals like this ever in the month of May.
About 1,000 homes and businesses are damaged, many residents now living in shelters. Flash floods are also proving deadly in northeast Arkansas. At least two are dead after a sport utility vehicle flipped on a water-covered road. An area teen is missing.
President Obama starts Memorial Day hosting a breakfast for families of fallen service members. Later this morning, he's going to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery, followed by speech.
In sports, Elio Castroneves is this year's Indianapolis 500 winner. This is the Brazilian's third Indy win. Danica Patrick took third place on Sunday, the highest finish ever for a woman.
And in basketball, the Orlando Magic took a 2-1 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Final. Orlando won 99-89 last night, and tonight the Denver Nuggets host the L.A. Lakers. L.A. leads the Western Conference Final 2-1. Wall Street's closed for Memorial Day. Most Asian markets posted modest gains today. And since it's Memorial Day, we are talking about barbecuing later on, but we want to know what your memories are of Memorial Day, or if you're just waking up and rolling over, because it's such a fabulous chance to catch up on your sleep. What are you doing today? Let us know, or perhaps some memories. 877-8-MY-TAKE to call in, or mytake@thetakeaway.org to email.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lanfer. North Korea has carried out an underground nuclear test, prompting widespread international concern. Pyongyang says the device it detonated was more powerful than a previous one tested in 2006. Meanwhile, a news agency in South Korea says the country also test-fired three short-range missiles. How should the U.S. and allies like South Korea and Japan deal with what they see as the North's increasingly boisterous behavior? Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke out this morning against the North.
They grow increasingly belligerent. I believe they increasingly isolate themselves from the international community.
For more, we spoke earlier with BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus in London, and I asked him, what did we know about the situation at this point?
Well, it was breaking news overnight. We know that there have been a small number of missile tests, but much more important is this claimed second testing of a nuclear device by the North Koreans. This is the second one, as I say. The first was back in October 2006. That test explosion didn't really meet up to the claims of the North Koreans. It was, to some extent, Western experts believe, less successful than they had hoped. So obviously the data will be being carefully analysed from this second test explosion to see whether it really does meet up to North Korea's claims.
In the past, North Korea has been in the news for famine-style conditions that have affected children and others. It's also been very, very testy about American journalists approaching its border. At this point, what has been the diplomatic reaction to North Korea and any word from North Korea?
Well, the diplomatic response, as you heard there, President Obama's response has been critical, a threat to international security and so on. That's been very much the views coming from other regional players, South Korea, Japan and so on. I think the problem is that there are really two sets of interpretations to what North Korea is doing. One is that this is all part of an effort to try and get the Obama administration's attention, to try and push the North Korea issue back up to the top of Washington's diplomatic agenda. The problem is that's a very US-centric view, if you like. There are many other people who argue that, in fact, what's going on is something of a succession change in North Korea itself, that the focus should be very much on North Korea's internal political situation, and that's what recent missile or rocket tests and now this nuclear test are actually about. And if that's the case, if this is largely focused internally on North Korea itself, then clearly the opportunities from the outside world, which are very limited anyway, to influence events in Pyongyang are even more restricted.
Talk for a minute about the reaction in South Korea, which is going through, if you will, its own internal roiling right now.
Well, there they are being cautious. They're clearly not happy about this, but they've watched as relations between North Korea and the United States have worsened in recent weeks. If you think back in April, when there was this UN criticism of North Korea's missile or rocket tests, as it would have it, the North Koreans at that point withdrew from the six-party talks. That's the diplomatic framework that was trying to get a rollback of North Korea's nuclear program in response for full recognition and peace on the Korean Peninsula and so on. The North Koreans have withdrawn from those talks. They say they're not coming back. They expelled international nuclear inspectors from their facilities. They've begun steps to put those facilities back into action, which had been disabled to some extent as part and parcel of the negotiations. So in South Korea, there is great concern. They don't, if you like, want to make a drama out of this crisis, but there is great uncertainty as to how this thing is going to be put back on an even keel and how, hopefully, certainly as far as South Korea, Japan, the United States is concerned, the North Koreans are going to be brought back to the negotiating table.
Jonathan, very quickly, what could be one or two international ripple effects for countries outside of North Korea and South Korea?
Well, I think the most important ripple effect is that if North Korea is seen to be able to do this kind of thing with impunity, then other countries around the world who will be wanting to perhaps develop nuclear capabilities are going to perhaps take their cue from the North Koreans. This has a bearing inevitably on America's handling of Iran's nuclear program, though, of course, it's got to be said the Iranians say they do not wish to have nuclear weapons, but
right.
Weakness on the North Korean front clearly is going to have an impact elsewhere.
Well, we want to thank you, Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Now we go to Catherine.
Hey, Farai, we are getting the breaking news this morning. Let's look ahead at the rest of the week.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
It's time for our agenda segment. It's a look at the stories that'll be making news this week. Tuesday, gay rights advocates will get an answer on Proposition 8. That was the California ballot initiative that made gay marriage illegal. We might have a Supreme Court nominee by the end of the week, Farai. And Thursday also, we're going to have Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas visiting the White House. But helping us go through all of this, we're going to go to our own Washington correspondent, the Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Catherine, good morning.
Right. Let's start with Proposition 8. It's back in court this week. What exactly are we expecting from a ruling in California tomorrow?
We got to recap very quickly on this case. It was back in May 50, back in May of 2008, about a year ago, the California Supreme Court ruled that you can't prohibit gay marriage under the Constitution. Now, California turned around. Opponents of gay marriage turned around, had a ballot initiative. Everyone's familiar with the fact that there are lots and lots and lots of ballot initiatives in California. California is very fond of making rules and laws. In this case, ruling on constitutional amendments with ballot initiative. Proposition 8 was the ballot initiative saying in California, marriage is between a man and a woman. It passed. Now, the gay rights advocates immediately sued, and in the intervening time, 18,000 couples, gay couples, have gotten married in California. So what's at stake in the immediate term is the legal legitimacy of those marriages. There are other ancillary issues at stake in California's law, whether or not really the crux of the legal question in this case is whether the majority, by vote, can take away the rights of a minority, regardless of what that minority is. Can you use ballot initiatives?
I was just going to say, this is actually almost a ruling on the future of ballot initiatives in California, right?
It is. It is. And the one really interesting part of that is we all heard a lot after the vote on Proposition 8 that minority groups, especially African Americans, had overwhelmingly voted for Proposition 8, i.e. against gay marriage. Now, the gay marriage activists dispute that. But anyway, that was what a lot of the exit polling said. But in this case, a lot of groups like the NAACP, like Hispanic groups and other African American groups filed briefs on behalf of the gay rights activists because really the legal crux of this is whether or not ballot initiatives can overturn efforts that are designed to help minorities. Or, if you look at it another way, can the majority take a vote to take away rights of a minority? Of course, they're concerned about that, so they're back on the side.
Okay,
they're
Todd,
back on the side
let's
with
keep
the, with
zooming
the
along this agenda. Quickly, are we going to have a Supreme Court nominee by the end of the week?
That's what everybody says. Dick Durbin, who's the Senate majority assistant whip, well, he's the whip, went on television, said he's been told by the White House that they'll have one this week. He hasn't been told when. He's a close confidant of Barack Obama, and he's on the Judiciary Committee, so he's probably got decent information.
All right, speed round. Quick, what's at stake for GM this week?
Oh, GM is facing a deadline pretty soon. GM is trying to get its bondholders to take a hit on about $27 billion of stake that they have in the company. So far, the bondholders, Catherine, are balking. If the bondholders continue to balk, it's bankruptcy for GM, it's restructuring, and then a whole nother round of figuring out what GM is going to be in the future. They're not expecting any success with the bondholders, by the way.
All right, we've got a revolving door of foreign leaders going in and out of the White House. I think it was King Abdullah of Jordan has come through. There was the trilateral meeting with Afghanistan and Pakistan. Last week, of course, Netanyahu from Israel. And this week,
Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority and leader of the Fatah faction in the West Bank, coming to visit the president. Watch for the president to make a very strong, unequivocal statement in favor of the so-called two-state solution. What that means is support for a Palestinian state. The backstory of this is that Abbas's mandate expires in a couple of months, and no one has scheduled new elections in Palestine. The Palestinian Authority government is weak. Neither Hamas nor the Palestinian Authority have scheduled new elections, and they might be facing a constitutional crisis there. So the president is going to give some legitimacy and some real support to Abbas this week. Of course, all of this culminates June 4th, which is in a little over a week. President travels to Cairo, to Egypt, to give a big speech on Mideast policy. A lot of people are expecting him to lay out the United States plan for a peace settlement between the Palestinians and Israelis. White House is trying to play that down at this point.
Todd, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, that, of course, is Takeaway correspondent Todd Zwillick, our man in Washington.
With some breaking news on Memorial Day, and since it is Memorial Day, we are talking about barbecuing, specifically barbecuing pork later on, but we want to know, what are your memories of Memorial Day? Is it something like barbecue? Is it going to a cemetery to visit your relatives who served or other people who served? Is it about taking a crisp flag out of the attic and hanging it out of your window? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lanfer. And do you know when it's not controversial to burn a flag?
No. When?
It's when the flag is so tattered that you can't hang it properly, and you essentially give it a burial by smoke. Today is Memorial Day. It's about remembering, and there is another tradition that goes besides memory, which is barbecue. And so we want to know, whether it's about military history or about just having fun, what do you remember the most about Memorial Day? Maybe a family memory, maybe your own. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Catherine?
Now, Farai, new research shows that a baby's brain is extremely active. And if you've ever spent 60 minutes trying to get 5 ounces of formula into a recalcitrant baby. But this isn't news for you. You already know that babies are born with minds of their own. But 100 billion neurons? Turns out that, contrary to previous thought, babies are not merely reflex machines. They're hyperactive learning engines, processing and growing at a rate that has huge implications for how we should be interacting with them. We're going to go now to science contributor Jonah Lehrer. He's going to break this down for us. Okay, Jonah, let's go back. How did we used to see the baby's brain?
Well, there was this traditional view that babies were lumps of need, that they were unconscious, that because they were lacking in all the talents that define the human mind, from language to the ability to pay rigorous, strict attention, that they really weren't humans, that they weren't complete humans. And so because they couldn't experience things like experience, like pain, that it really didn't matter how you dealt with them. And I think one of the most profound implications of this was that until the 1970s, until the late 1970s, it wasn't uncommon to perform surgery on babies without anesthesia. So people would conduct, you know, gruesome surgeries and just give babies muscle paralytics. That because we assume babies couldn't experience pain, or at least they wouldn't remember it for more than just a few seconds, that we really didn't give them anesthesia.
Wow. So what do we know now that's new?
Well, I think one of the emerging views, and this is championed by a woman named Allison Gopnik, a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, is that babies are actually more conscious than adults, that for so long we've seen babies as unconscious, basically, just these lumps who just want to eat and cry and sleep. And now we think babies are actually more conscious than us. And that this comes down to the particular ways babies pay attention. So one of my favorite metaphors for this concerns the idea of adults pay attention using a spotlight, which means we shine a very bright spotlight on a very narrow slice of reality. Babies, in contrast, use what's called the lantern mode of attention, which is that even though their attention may be less focused, less fixated, they actually pay more attention to a greater range of things.
Wow. So how does the baby brain differ physiologically from the adult brain?
Well, it's actually more stuffed full of neurons and neuronal connections. So the baby brain is actually better connected than the adult brain. One of the interesting side effects of maturity as you get older is that maturity is actually represented from the perspective of the brain as the pruning of cells. You actually eliminate cells, which makes your brain
in a few.
which although it makes your brain more efficient, it's easier for you to, you know, do things that you're used to doing, like driving down the street. It actually inhibits the kind of remote associations that define things like creativity and you know, learning.
Yeah, I have to go back to the image of operating on infants, on babies, without using any kind of anesthetic. How could we do that now that we know what we know?
It is a pretty horrifying idea, but I think it was very much grounded in our perspective, in our view on the baby brain, that we saw the baby brain as so undeveloped, as so immature, that it really didn't matter what you did to it, that babies really couldn't experience pain. They weren't fully conscious yet. And so that's where the view came from. So I think this science does have big implications.
Well, in fact, let's talk about the interaction, you know, off the operating table, even how we think about interactions with babies and toddlers. How is that going to change given this new research?
I think it's important to give babies lots of stimulation. I think to realize that babies are more hyperconscious. So there's a great experiment. done by research at the University of Michigan, where they give people two decks of cards, and they tell people, pay attention to the left deck of cards and ignore the right deck of cards, the deck of cards on the right. What you find is adults are very good at doing that, that if you quiz adults after the fact, that they're very good at remembering the deck of cards on the left, and they have no memory of the deck of cards on the right. Little kids, it turns out, are actually much better at remembering the deck of cards on the right than adults, and that's simply because their lantern shines everywhere. They're more aware of things outside of this narrow spotlight of attention. So I think it's important to take that into account. Alison Gopnik, she's got this great metaphor where she says being a baby is like going to Paris for the first time every day, in that you're so hyper aware of everything going around you. It all seems so strange and new and intoxicating and exciting. You just want to take it all in. And that's what it's like to be a baby. So I think it's important to think about that when you're interacting with babies, realizing that babies, their eyes are going everywhere and they're really taking it all in. So give them lots of stimulation. Feed their brain.
When we say give them lots of stimulation, I don't think that necessarily approximates what most of us do, which is to lean over the stroller and go, oh my God, you're so cute. What do you mean?
Well, that's a great form of stimulation too. It's just give babies something to look at, give them something to learn, give them ideas to put inside their head and try to make sense of.
Now,
and so that conclude everything from, you know, the Mozart symphony playing in the background to something on the television to the sound of your voice to, you know, there's nothing more important for a baby than ordinary social interactions.
Well, and let's talk about our own brains. What implications does this research have for adult brains?
Well, I think there is some intriguing research suggesting that sometimes it's actually good to think like a baby. So, for instance, there are some brain scans of jazz musicians during moments of improv, and what they find is that jazz musicians, in a sense, think like a baby, that they actually inhibit. In order to come up with these spontaneous new melodies, they actually inhibit a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is very underdeveloped in the baby brain. And so this allows them to generate on the fly all sorts of new associations, new ideas, new songs, new melodies. And so at a certain point, it's actually very good to relax our attention, to use that lantern mode of attention just like a baby. There's a great Charles Baudelaire quote where he said, genius is nothing more or less than childhood rediscovered at will. And I think that's absolutely true when it comes to the brain.
Paris every day. Jonah Lehrer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. That was a lot of fun.
Jonah Lehrer is our takeaway science correspondent. His latest book is How We Decide. Femi Okay is our representative from the newsroom.
Thank you very much.
The headlines.
Hello there. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. President Obama condemned North Korea's claims that it carried out an underground nuclear test today. The president said the test was a threat to peace and warranted action by the international community. The United Nations Security Council is expected to hold an emergency meeting later today. North Korea says that the latest nuclear test was more powerful than the one it claimed to have conducted in October 2006. And in international news, riots have broken out in the Indian state of Punjab after a violent dispute at a Sikh temple in Austria left a guru dead and several other Sikhs injured. Sikh protesters took to the streets of Jalandhar, clashing with police, and a curfew has been imposed in the city, and the Indian army has been deployed. Let's look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lamfer here in the studio with Farai Chidea. It's Memorial Day, a traditional kickoff to barbecue season, and we're collecting recipes on our website. In fact, we even have some from our staff, so give us yours too. Also, coming up later, we're going to talk with Craig Samuels, owner of the Brooklyn restaurants Peaches and The Smoke Joint. He's known for fare that hails from the southern U.S. In fact, we even have a web video of him on our website.
I started doing this dish because I wanted to show people that Southern American food was so much more than fried chicken and mashed potatoes and macaroni and cheese. So this is a take on a classic Italian dish, prosciutto with melon.
Oh, what is it? You are going to have to go to our website. That is thetakeaway.org, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. And while you're there, tell us about your Memorial Day traditions.
Well, thanks so much. The former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was arrested in July of last year after 11 years on the run. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia accuses him of genocide, trying to wipe out Bosnia's Croat and Muslim population. At least 7,500 people, died. Karadzic's lawyers say they've actually got an ace in the hole, evidence showing he was promised he wouldn't stand trial for war crimes. Richard Holbrooke made that promise, apparently. He was the U.S. envoy to the Balkans. These days, he's the U.S. special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. For more now, we go to Purdue University history professor Charles Ingrao. First, we want to hear a clip showing how excited Richard Holbrooke was when he captured Karadzic in action.
This is a historic day. One of the worst men in the world and the most wanted man in Europe, the Osama bin Laden, if you will, of Europe, has finally been captured after 12 years.
So, Professor, with that kind of language being inserted into the debate, why do you think Holbrooke would have agreed to no war crimes trial?
Because it already was evident to him that the U.S. military and the French and British, who were co-sharing the implementation of the peace agreement, that none of the militaries of those three allies were going to go after any war criminals, let alone Radovan Karadzic. By the time Holbrooke is brought onto the scene, it is already clear to him and to the State Department, to its dismay, that the military will not be arresting them. So when Holbrooke is meeting with Karadzic's representatives and he's trying to get Karadzic to get out of Bosnian Serb politics, he just throws in an oral pledge that we will leave you alone. We will not arrest you. I don't believe from our sources that there's any evidence that he actually said you will not be prosecuted, rather that you will be left alone and not apprehended by the implementation force, the Anglo-French-American-led force that had 60,000 troops on the ground in Bosnia and was trying to avoid war criminal encounters at all costs.
Well, you know, this is a stranger-than-fiction moment where Karadzic was hiding under an assumed name, living as a holistic healer. Who in the world is watching this case closely? I mean, what kinds of audiences are there? I would presume that people from Bosnia are watching. Who else?
Yes, well, the Bosnians are watching because they have, for the last 15 years, been very distressed. In fact, I should say since 1992, at the diffidence of the international community. And so their rage is simply being fed by the duplicity of the international community, by its diffidence. The Serbs are also extremely interested because even though this man is a heinous figure, as is his partner, the commander of the Bosnian Serb military, Matko Mladic, who murdered 8,000 Bosnian men and boys at Srebrenica in 1995, the Serbs are still, a great number of Serbs regard these two men as heroes, and they are looking to see Karadzic vindicated in his claim that he's immune from prosecution. A third group that is very much interested is the human rights community, which is international in scope, which has shared with us scholars the dismay at the unwillingness of international actors to put humanitarian concerns and concerns of justice ahead of their own narrow national self-interest.
Quickly, Professor, Richard Holbrooke now is representing the United States in Afghanistan and Pakistan. How does this assertion by the former Bosnian Serb leader complicate his current role?
Well, first of all, I should add an answer to a more important question, and that is, will this in any way affect the ICTY decision to go ahead with the prosecution? And the answer here is no. That the United States, even if Bill Clinton had known and approved of what Holbrooke was promising, that has no bearing on the jurisdiction that the ICTY has. In fact, our evidence is that Holbrooke didn't tell very many people, mainly people under him in the chain of command, but not Albright, the Secretary of State, and not Clinton. His
freelancing was something that was already sort of winked at by his superiors. Do what you have to do was the message he got from Washington. And this is a very minor event in the overall picture here. And certainly given the importance of the mission in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which I don't think anybody could overestimate, what happened, a dozen years ago is not of any bearing on the India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan problems.
Thanks so much. And that was Charles Ingrao, professor of history at Purdue University. He also directs the research team, the Scholars Initiative, Confronting the Yugoslav Controversies. Femi?
Thank you very much. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama condemned claims from North Korea that it carried out an underground nuclear test today. The president says that the test was a threat to peace. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, told CNN that the U.S. is prepared to protect American interests.
Obviously, we've got forces deployed to that part of the world. We have had for a significant period of time. We've got over 25,000 troops who are stationed in South Korea.
Later today, the United Nations Security Council is expected to hold an emergency meeting about North Korea's apparent nuclear testing. President Obama is celebrating Memorial Day by placing a wreath on the Tomb of the Unknowns. And in sports, at the Indy 500, Elio Castroneves took home his third Indy win on Sunday. Castroneves was so emotional, the track was slick.
I already cried in my victory lane, so on the victory lap. Now it's just, I'm getting the energy back, but what a great day.
Oh, how sweet. The victory came just 2 days after a jury threw out the last charge he faced in a federal tax evasion trial, which could have sent him to prison for 6 years and ended his racing career. Staying with sports, in basketball, the Orlando Magic took a 2-1 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Final. Orlando won 99-89 last night, and tonight the Denver Nuggets host the LA Lakers. Los Angeles leads the Western Conference Final 2-1. And finally, in international news, in France, the Church of Scientology heads to trial today. Seven prominent members of the church's two main branches in France are accused of fraud. The case centres on a complaint by a woman who says she was pressurised into paying large sums of money after being offered a free personality test. France regards the organisation as a sect. That's a look at stories making headlines today.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. Memorial Day can hold different emotions for every soldier who has served. For some, a day to look back and honor the dead. New York resident Kristen L. Rouse served in Afghanistan in 2006 as a sergeant in the 10th Mountain Division. She's now a first lieutenant in the Army National Guard. In Afghanistan, she participated in fallen comrade ceremonies, where the caskets of fallen soldiers are driven around the base and servicemen and women line up to salute them. Rouse didn't know most of the fallen soldiers, and then one day...
One of the soldiers who did pass by once was a member of my unit. His name is Roger Pena. He was promoted to the rank of sergeant and awarded a Bronze Star posthumously. He was killed by the Taliban in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, in a logistics convoy. He was among the best in my unit, and that's no exaggeration. And he was also a loving father with a wife and two little boys. You know, to stand there and watch good friends of his carrying the casket up into the airplane. It was just really one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever experienced.
Some servicemen and women use this day to remember the living as well as the dead. William Dennis Brown Jr. is a retired Navy SEAL on Memorial Day. He will remember many of his comrades who remain in the service, starting with...
Master Chief Stephen Redbow. I think he's getting ready to retire now, but I was a pretty young and aggressive SEAL. And he went out of his way to kind of teach me the importance of being a measured person. Then there's other guys that are still in that are good friends of mine, and I don't know how they do it, you know, for this long, working at that type of, that high level. Danny Albrecht, Sergio Zepeda, gentlemen, friends, man, I tip my hat off to you. God bless you.
Not every service member looks back on Memorial Day. Some servicemen and women have to look forward. First Lieutenant Russell Galletti is with the Ohio National Guard, and in 2 weeks, he will start training for a six-month deployment to Afghanistan.
The largest group on my mind are the soldiers that I'm going to be leading this year, and making sure that I'm going to do right by them, and that everything's ready for them, so that when we start training and enter into combat again, that I've led them as well as I can.
One thing is the same on every Memorial Day. It's a time to remember heroic acts that take place during wartime. Brian Adams served in Iraq with the 1st Infantry Division around 2004 to 2005, and he remembers his former squad leader, Alwin C. Cash.
He was in a Bradley fighting vehicle in Samarra, which is a town in northern Iraq, and his vehicle was hit by an improvised explosive device, and the vehicle was on fire. He was able to get out, but there were still soldiers trapped inside, so he went back in there, and he managed to rescue the two soldiers that were trapped inside, but in the process, he got burned over 70% of his body, and he succumbed to his wounds about a month later.
As these servicemen and women told us, Memorial Day is about the sacrifice of those who have fallen and the influence of those who live on and the uncertain future for those about to deploy. Kristen L. Rouse, who we talked to at the beginning, has written a blog post about her fallen comrade, Roger Pena. And maybe that's a way for you to celebrate your Memorial Day. Go take a look at that. It's at thetakeaway.org. And meanwhile, thanks for joining us this Memorial Day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lanfer. It is Memorial Day. Among other things, it's a kickoff to barbecue season. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about barbecuing pork in particular. But we want to know, what are your memories of Memorial Day? What are your traditions? What's in your secret sauce, for example? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thank you very much. At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, North Korea says it has tested a nuclear weapon and several missiles. It's not confirmed, but there are independent reports showing seismic activity in the area. Worldwide condemnation is rolling in from President Obama, from China, Europe and the United Nations. The North last tested in 2006, and today's reported test may be several times larger than the last one. Breakfast is about to be served at the White House in 12 minutes from now. President Obama starts Memorial Day hosting a breakfast for families of fallen service members. And later this morning, he will lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery. Florida's governor says that the Daytona Beach region is a disaster area. Days of rain have left a waist-deep water and tens of millions of dollars in damage. The governor wants President Obama to declare a federal disaster so the area can get more cleanup money. Now, about 1,000 homes and businesses are damaged, and many residents are now living in shelters. Flash floods are proving deadly in northeast Arkansas. At least two are dead after a sports utility vehicle flipped on a water-covered road. An area teenager is also missing. A Nobel Prize winner credited with discovering the research that paved the way for developing Viagra has died. He discovered that nitric oxide could enlarge blood vessels, and this was a key in finding a road to developing the anti-impotence drug. Now, his friend, Dr. Gautam Chaudhary, paid tribute to Fergot.
It was really the basis of his research
that led to the development of Viagra, and I'm sure to the lay public, that's an important thing. And, you know, Nobel Prize is given to people for humanity, and I think that that is a humanitarian cause.
Dr. Robert Virchow, he died at the age of 92. He did some of the amazing research that led to the development of Viagra. And that is a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning. Catherine, do not smirk. It's a humanitarian exercise.
Hey, you know what? All I can say is that we as journalists covered that Viagra got paid for by health companies when the birth control pill didn't. So there's a lot of blue babies running around and a lot of blue humor we can't talk about. Thanks, Femi. And
you're welcome.
On a more serious topic, we're talking about fallen veterans from all sorts of different American conflicts. But back to a little bit more of a light topic, it's barbecue time and there's a breakout of H1N1 or the swine flu. What do you really know that you can't actually learn from all papers is that you can't catch H1N1 from eating pork. That is the sound of pork on the Barbie. For those who eat pork, marketers call it the other white meat. It's snackalicious. Our next guest is Craig Samuels, a Brooklyn-based barbecue pro who runs the restaurants The Smoke Joint and the Southern Food Spot Peaches. Hey, Craig.
Hello.
So we're going to start off by saying that we're going to hit a possible veggie option. I see it has some meat on it right now, but we might be able to rectify that for folks who don't even eat the meat. Let's start out, first of all, laying the scene here, Catherine. Are you smelling what I'm smelling?
Were you talking to me? I can't even concentrate. There's pulled pork over there.
Mm-hmm.
There's ribs. There's greens.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the good of the interview, you should just keep talking and maybe I'll just do a little taste.
And the long arm of the Catherine will go across. It's a beautiful platter you laid out for us. Let's start with pulled pork. That's a controversy in and of itself because there's about 10 million recipes. What is yours like?
Well, at the restaurant, what we do is we smoke the meat for about 8 hours after rubbing it with our proprietary blend.
Made that sound nasty.
No, he makes it sound lucrative.
Well, I mean, it's very carnal. So there are other ways to cook the pork. If you can't smoke it, you can easily roast it in the oven. And I think that's the recipe that I gave to your editors.
Mm-hmm. And we should point out that we're going to have recipes online at thetakeaway.org.
Absolutely.
Now, people can go to war over pulled pork, right? I mean, the different ways to make it?
North Carolina, South Carolina, New York style, which is our style.
New York? There's a New York style?
Does New York have vinegar? No?
Of course there's vinegar in New York style.
I guess we know where he stands on
that
battle.
Yeah, some people are not fans of the vinegar in the barbecue. Other people make super vinegary sauces. I see that you've got a beautifully toasted bun with a big pile of pulled pork chunks, and you've got sauce on the side.
I just want to thank you for beautifully toasted first.
We
do serve our sauce on the side at the restaurant, and the vinegar is essential because the pork itself is so rich that you need just a little bit of acid to cut through it. Unlike North Carolina style, especially the Eastern style, it's not vinegar heavy. But there's a tinge of vinegar in pretty much everybody's barbecue sauce, a little bit of sweetness, a little bit of acid, a little bit of spice. Generally, you want to balance the flavors.
All right. Before I move on to more food talk, has all of this talk, New York has actually been one of those places hit by H1N1. We've seen school closings. We've seen a couple deaths. Has anyone ever asked you, is it safe to eat pork?
Thankfully, no. I would say that since this whole thing started, most of our customers who are there for the pork,
trying to get easy and greasy and lick the sauce off their fingers.
Yeah, they kind of circumvent the whole H1N1 thing and come straight in for the pork.
All right. I want to go to a dish that I don't recognize. It's some kind of salad with chunks of fruit and what looks like ham. Explain.
Well, that's our signature dish at Peaches. It's a watermelon salad. And, you know, just like the barbecue, it's got to be well balanced. So you've got the sweetness of the watermelon and a little bit of sour from pickled onions and pickled ginger. We throw in a little bit of herbaceous mint and then the saltiness from the ham. It's our version of the Italian melon with prosciutto.
Now, if you are a veggie lover, could you put in, say, cured cheese, like a Parmigiano?
Well, absolutely. And if I were going to add cheese to that salad in place of the ham, I would probably add feta, which has the same sort of saltiness that comes through, a little bit of creaminess. I will tell you that that salad is available at our restaurant without the ham, but not many people ask for it that way anymore.
Yeah, not many vegetarians usually go to the barbecue restaurants. Let me ask you, everyone has a tradition that brings them to barbecue. What brought you to barbecue and to wanting to do it as a full-time profession?
Well, I'm going to give a shout-out to Robert Pearson, a London hairdresser who ended up in Texas, loved barbecue, opened a barbecue restaurant in Connecticut, and then eventually dragged it to, yes, a London hairdresser who opens a barbecue restaurant in Connecticut brought me to barbecue. And then he ended up in Long Island City. And I went to that restaurant for 3 or 4 years until he closed, and then he reopened at Jackson Heights. And then I would drag my bones from Bed-Stuy to Jackson Heights for barbecue.
Right. Did he let you in the kitchen to learn his secret sauce?
I never met the man, and I don't want his sauce. Our sauce is so good.
You've got ribs over there. Can you tell us something a little bit about those?
Well, the baby back ribs are the only barbecue item that we serve that's not served dry or sauce on the side. It's these are wet ribs. They're smoked for about 2.5 hours, and then we coat them with our delicious sauce, smoke joint.
Hey, what do you recommend for someone who might be trying their first barbecue today?
Someone who might be trying their first barbecue. Well, I'd certainly hope that they're new to America.
No, but, you know, especially like if you're out of college or something and you're putting together your first party.
Grab some hickory chips. Grab what's the name for it? The hardwood charcoal as opposed to the charcoal briquettes. They burn a little slower, a little lower, and you'll end up with a very tender piece of meat if you just take your time.
Craig Samuels brought in a beautiful plate. You know, we also have a recipe for his famous watermelon salad. If you want to change your menu from the pedestrian to the upscale, you'll find that, plus the video at thetakeaway.org. Craig, thanks.
Hey, you know, you can actually see him assemble some of his recipes on a video that we have at thetakeaway.org. And we also have some special grilling recipes from our staff. You can send us yours, too. And here's your takeaway.
If North Korea is seen to be able to do this kind of thing with impunity, then other countries around the world who will be wanting to perhaps develop nuclear capabilities are going to perhaps take their cue from the North Koreans.
That was the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus talking about North Korea's claim that it is test-firing nuclear missiles. And we've been asking you what your Memorial Day traditions are for, right, listen to this. Bill Blevins told us, my birthday is May 29th and always falls on or around the Memorial Day holiday. I was born with a serious congenital heart defect. We didn't know how many birthdays I'd have, so his whole family gathers every Memorial Day for what they call Billy's birthday breakfast. He's about to turn 39.
That's fantastic. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Catherine Lanford.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
It's the start of summer, and for some of us, the start of a summer internship. You know, fetching coffee, explaining Twitter to your boss. Alex Liebman, 19, at McAllister College, has got his internship all lined up. Hey, Alex, what'll you be doing?
I am harvesting strawberries, Swiss chard, and carrots, and I'm collecting chicken eggs.
Dude, forget a summer in a cubicle. For more and more college students, this summer's internship is down at the farm. Oh, McDonald had an intern. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 25th. It's Memorial Day. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lanfer in here with Farai Chidea. Hey, good morning.
Hey, coming up this hour, the detainees at Guantanamo Bay get most of the press, but prisoners inside an American airbase in Afghanistan might be a more interesting story. We'll take you inside, plus the surprising origin of Memorial Day. That and more ahead, but first these headlines.
Worldwide, condemnation is pouring in about North Korea's announcement of a nuclear weapons test today, including from a country that often supports the North. China is clearly stating opposition to the testing, saying that Pyongyang should avoid these types of actions and return to the negotiating table. President Obama is also strongly condemning the incident. The United Nations chief as well says a nuclear test would clearly violate UN rules. There are also reports of new short-range missile testing from North Korea. All the testing is still unconfirmed, but top Pentagon officer Admiral Mike Mullen says it may be the real deal.
And while it'll take us a couple days to verify this test, certainly there's no indication that it wasn't as they say.
Now, there was seismic activity near North Korea's test site, seeming to back up the North's claim. Pyongyang last tested a nuclear device in 2006, and today's reported test may be several times larger than the last.
President Obama begins Memorial Day hosting a breakfast for families of fallen service members. Later this morning, he's going to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery, followed by a speech. And in Florida, the governor says Daytona Beach is a disaster. Days of rain have left waist-deep water and tens of millions of dollars in damage. The governor wants President Obama to declare a federal disaster so the area can get cleanup money. About 1,000 homes and businesses are damaged. Many residents are in shelters.
Now, in sports, Elio Castroneves is this year's Indianapolis 500 winner. It was an emotional victory.
I already cried in my victory lane, so on the victory lap. Now it's just, I think I'm getting the energy back, but what a great day.
This is the Brazilian's third Indy win. Danica Patrick took third place, the highest finish ever for a woman.
And in basketball, the Orlando Magic took a 2-1 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Final. Orlando won 99-89 last night. Tonight, the Denver Nuggets host the L.A. Lakers. The Lakers lead the Western Conference Final 2-1. Wall Street's closed, and later this hour, we're going to talk about non-traditional internships. A lot of people doing farming this summer. Want to know what was your best or worst intern experience? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer here in the studio with Farai Chidea. North Korea has carried out an underground nuclear test, prompting widespread international concern. Pyongyang says the device that detonated was more powerful than one previously tested in 2006. Meanwhile, a news agency in South Korea says that the North Koreans have also test-fired a total of 3 short-range missiles. We're joined now by Dr. Jim Walsh. He's a specialist in international security and research and a research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. Okay, Dr. Walsh, let's just try to describe this act. Are we talking about a political act or a nuclear act?
Well, it is a nuclear act that is more political than military. I know listeners are waking up and they're saying, my gosh, North Korea had a nuclear test, a rocket test last month. You know, are we going to have a conflict on the Korean Peninsula? And the answer is no. This is an unwelcome development for lots of different reasons, but it doesn't mean that suddenly North Korea is going to launch a nuclear missile. It has neither the intention nor really even the capability right now to launch a missile armed with a nuclear warhead, but it's certainly going to unsettle things in the region.
Jim, you're making it sound like in this country we go on a cable show and yell at each other, and in North Korea they do a nuclear test, and that's how you know that there's something going on?
Well, it's certainly true that there is a lot of that sort of thing going around. In this case, what you have is with this test, there's going to be a debate in the intelligence community and in capitals around the world as to what it means. Normally, we would have thought of this as bargaining behavior, that North Korea is trying to create a crisis to improve their leverage going into a negotiation. That's what they did back in 2006.
Well, in fact, people are suggesting that's what's going on now, that this is North Korea's way of saying, yoo-hoo, President Obama.
Yeah, and let's hope that that's the case, because that's the good scenario. The alternative scenario, and the one that people are starting to consider, is that this isn't driven by North Korean foreign policy, but rather is driven by the internal political situation, that Kim Jong-il has had a stroke, that there is some sort of succession or transition process underway now, and that this test and the missile launches are coming together more because of the internal situation than because they're interested in bargaining with foreigners, in Beijing.
Yeah, but no matter how domestic this particular conversation is, it's getting international attention. President Obama, it just came across the wire, is accusing North Korea of defying international community, for instance, with the new missile tests.
Well, I think you're right to point that out, because just a month ago we had the missile test, and then everyone came out and issued their statements of condemnation and talked about sanctions. And now that we've had a subsequent nuclear test, those same leaders are sort of in a bind. They have to come out and issue stern warnings, and they have to come out and start talking about sanctions. But I think everyone knows that the sanctions aren't going to really mean very much in this case. And again, if it's driven by internal dynamics rather than an interest in negotiation, then it really doesn't matter what the outside world says or does, because North Korea is doing it for its own reason.
Quickly, I just want to talk about what's going on in South Korea right now. They have the suicide of the previous leader. You have the new conservative leader in power who, in fact, is undoing a lot of the sunshine policy. This has got to be making South Koreans feel even more tentative than they had before.
Well, I can't imagine what it's like, what it's been in Seoul this week with the suicide of former President No, and now this. We're going to have to wait and see how that develops. But there's one thing I do know, and that is the reaction in Japan will be unambiguous and certain. These tests, nuclear, missile, whatever, tend to roil Japan's domestic politics. And I think what you'll see within 24 hours is a statement from the president reassuring Japan, and probably Secretary Gates visiting Japan and trying to say, hey, ally, we've got your back. Don't worry. North Korea isn't going to threaten you.
All right. Jim Walsh, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. Jim Walsh, specialist in international security at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Security Studies Program.
Catherine, my commute was a little different this morning. I was in a car in the wee hours of the morning when we get here, and the guy at the wheel was a little upset because he was asking, why are you going to block off the streets in Times Square? That's right. Times Square is going pedestrian. No cars allowed. Here's New York Transportation Commissioner Jeanette Sadik Khan describing her vision.
We're going to have tables and chairs out here and planters out here and fanciful street designs out here, all indicating that this is a different kind of a place. This is a different kind of experience.
Now we've got Matt Dellinger, who was there when the city closed Times Square to traffic. He's a transportation writer who's contributed to The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and he's a friend of our show. Hey.
Hi. Good morning.
So what was it like?
Well, it was last night. It was very, kind of exciting. It felt like transportation history, I guess, which maybe not everyone's as excited as I am about. But, I've been to an interstate ribbon cutting before. which is probably one of the last. And this felt like maybe the first of something.
I'm laughing only because what a great transportation geek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here I am.
You were at the ribbon. Yeah. For people who, when they think of Times Square across the country, mm-hmm. they have images of it at New Year's Eve, right? Mm-hmm. Full of people. Certainly a pedestrian mall then. Give us an idea what it looks like normally, what it's going to look like now.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, usually Times Square is on or off. I mean, either it's full of cars or it's full of people. And this is going to be not quite either. They're not closing Times Square completely. All of the cross streets are still active. You're still going to be able to drive east to west through Times Square. And 7th Avenue is still open. It's just the segments of Broadway. And if you think of Times Square, what makes it Times Square is that weird angle that Broadway cuts with 7th Avenue, and it creates all that space. So it was kind of a traffic nightmare is the way that the DOT is sort of helping to pitch this, is they're actually solving a traffic problem while creating a pedestrian space.
You know, I'm wondering, New York is one of these places where you have certain parts of the city on a grid and then other parts of the city totally like freeform and weird kind of, you know, dead alleys and things like that. Why the heck in the first place was there this cross section of these two major streets? Do we know?
Well, I think it's because Broadway always existed as a sort of, you know, it was an animal trail, I believe. I
right.
might be making this up.
Cows walked on.
Exactly. It was a very old road. And so when they imposed the grid, they just kept Broadway there.
All right. Well, you've got a lot of people weighing in on this. And there's a guy who sells tickets to Broadway plays on the street.
Mm-hmm.
He seems enthusiastic.
I think that when they do block it off and it's just foot traffic, it's going to be awesome. There'll be 3 times more people. That's more promotions for everyone that's around here, everyone in Times Square, all of the Broadway shows. I mean, it's going to make it a lot more accessible for us to do our job.
All right. Did you get any reactions?
Well, I heard plenty of that, actually, from anyone whose job it is to interface with people in Times Square is going to be very happy about this. There's a phenomenon called induced traffic, which is basically when you add a lane to a highway, all you're doing is making more room for more cars. And so you actually increase the number of cars rather than alleviating the traffic. You just create more traffic. And the same is true of people. If you give people more pedestrian space, then more people will come. I mean, this will actually – this isn't the same number of people in Times Square filling a bigger space. This is going to mean more people in Times Square.
Well, you know, there's a whole international aspect to it. You've had cities like London regulating traffic. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a guy named Sam Schwartz, a.k.a. Gridlock Sam.
Gridlock
and
Sam.
One of our reporters here got a little bit of sound from Gridlock Sam.
You're going to see a jump from here to Chicago, to San Francisco, to even the land of the car in Los Angeles. They're beginning to talk about these kinds of solutions.
All right. Is this going to have a ripple effect?
Absolutely, I think. I mean, it's already happening. San Francisco actually has a program called Pavement to Parks, and just over a week ago, they dedicated their first pedestrian plaza, nowhere near on the scale of Times Square. It's 17th Street, I think, in the Castro District. They closed off a block that wasn't getting a lot of traffic, and they've got 3 more in the works. But, you know, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, the New York City Transportation Commissioner, is also the head of the National Association of City Transportation Officials, and she was... I'm told partly elected to that position because she sort of brings this national perspective. And I think that if they have anything to say about it, it will become a national phenomenon.
Finally, do you think that Times Square, which has gone from cruddy, filled with porn and peep shows, now it's all Disney-fied, which some people don't like. What's the future of Times Square?
Well, the future of Times Square is going to be a lot like the past. If you look at some of the old pictures, you've got vehicles and people and animals sharing this giant space. I don't know if the animals are going to come back, but it's going to be, you know, kind of a little bit more rowdy. The cars were actually kind of boring in a way.
Well, that's going to be a crossroads of the world. And we also want to thank Arun Venugopal for that tape from WNYC. We were talking with Matt Dellinger, a transportation writer who has contributed to The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, friend to The Takeaway. Thanks again, Matt. And
I want to see the cows come back to Broadway.
Yeah, you know, New York has done some weird things. At the World Trade Center site, you also had an artist who put a field of wheat there right before the start of the construction. So, cows? Maybe.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Catherine Lanfer, and we're talking about non-traditional internships. A lot of folks are doing things outdoors. It made us wonder, what was your best or worst intern experience? I once got to be a rare books researcher looking at illustrated manuscripts from the 16th century. I got special security clearance. It was fabulous. What did you do? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Wow, that sounds incredible. Well, things are a little different these days, you know. Forget about interning at Vogue or whatever traditional internship you might have been thinking about. Farmhand is this year's hot summer job for students at liberal arts colleges. No, really. Farmers are reporting 2- and 3-fold jumps this year, and young people who want to pull up weeds and pick tomatoes for little or no pay. Joining us now to tell us a little bit more about this trend is Kim Severson from our partner, The New York Times. Hey, whatever happened to fetching coffee and sharpening pencils? What's going on here?
Well, this year, the liberal arts student who's given up backpacking in Europe or, like you say, filing papers in their dad's office, they're heading to the farms in record numbers, we found out.
What kind of farms?
Well, these, of course, are not the big agricultural industrial farms that we think about. These are smaller farms, farms where they're using organic practices, where they're spreading manure instead of artificial fertilizer, and where they're selling to farmers markets and CSAs.
What is it in particular for this generation that makes this kind of sustainable farming, I think is what we're talking about, attractive?
Well, it's about food politics. And I think in the ways that perhaps protesting against the Vietnam War or marching for civil rights were the statement of a generation, food politics is the issue for students this year.
What exactly do the kids hope to get out of this?
Well, one would imagine that they are not expecting calluses and sore muscles, which is really what they get. I think the idea is they want to change the food system. They're arriving, they talk about in the story in the Times, they're arriving with soft hands and dog-eared copies of Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. They want to change the world through food, and I think it's a couple of things. One is the economy is not so great, as you may have noticed. You can go hang out on a farm over the summer, and even if the pay's lousy, it's better than no job at all. They also get a chance to feel like they're doing something personal, something that means something to their friends and to themselves that's beyond Facebook and the digital world that they live in.
How many of them know the actual drudgery involved?
Well, there's where the rubber hits the road. And I think for the farmers, it can be a little frustrating to get these PC English majors telling them how to handle their sheep when they've never seen a live sheep before in their lives.
Give me an example.
Well, I've talked to a bunch of farmers and people who coordinate some of these internships, and one of them said there was a student just this year in Florida who called up to try to, I think the phrase we used to say was narc on her farmer. He had been using antibiotics on one of the sheep, and he had an organic farm, and certainly you're not supposed to sell meat from animals that were raised with antibiotics. But if an animal's sick, you take them out of the herd and treat them with antibiotics. She just was having none of this and called the internship coordinator to rat out her farmer.
Did he make her muck out a stall somewhere?
Well, I hope so. I don't know quite how that story ended, but I'm guessing that she's probably not going to stay on that farm for very long.
So instead of a poli-sci major with an internship on Capitol Hill, it's food politics and an internship on an actual hill?
Exactly. Very nice.
You're welcome. So these internships, I'm assuming low paying, there's any money at all?
Well, generally you get room and board, and often that's in, sometimes it's just a three-sided lean-to, sometimes it's a trailer. Some of the students actually live in the farmhouse with farm families. They get a small stipend for groceries, usually. They certainly get, all the fresh vegetables they can eat. Some farms are actually trying to, they have a certain social justice consciousness and are paying the students what they pay their regular farmhands. These are farms that are a little more established, large organic farms in California where a student might make $300 a week.
Any particular region in the country, or and is it just this country?
Well, certainly, there have been organic sort of summer internships in Europe. Canada has a very strong tradition of this. In this country, it's coming along. It's a little bit later than some of the other countries. But Maine has a very strong program, as California, obviously. But there's also programs in Iowa, in North Carolina. These small farms are popping up all over, and they need this kind of help.
What about college credits?
Some colleges...
Wait a minute. Let me sound more parental. What about college credits? What do you think I'm sending you to school school for.
Exactly. I'm not spending all that money for you to pick tomatoes all summer. As far as I can tell, and this is, again, there's no central repository keeping track of all of this, but about a third of the students might be getting some kind of credit, because increasingly schools are offering the ecology of food and science departments. They're offering food politics classes and humanities studies. It's going beyond just the traditional agricultural studies.
I can't help but wonder, if you're a parent, you have a kid that you had to yell at to make him or her pick up the room, and now they're like, Mom, Dad, I'm going to go weed.
Well, I think they probably think, good luck, Mr. Farmer, with my lazy son. But, you know, the other hand, a lot of these kids are sons and daughters of parents who grew up eating organic food, who have a very environmental consciousness. They are sort of the children of the corn, the offspring of parents who themselves thought eating organic food was a very radical move.
And so I want to go back to the farmers, though. What are they making of this?
Well, I think for some farmers, they're glad to see the help. I mean, obviously, it's inexpensive help. Some farmers, though, and for example, I talked to Rick and Christy Knoll, who run a farm in Brentwood, California, that is having their 30-year anniversary. They were the vanguards of organic farming. They supply to Chez Panisse and, you know, have done a lot of groundbreaking work with biodynamic farming. They just gave up on interns. They felt like one too many fields was planted incorrectly. They'll send people out to weed. They'll pull up the wrong things. They'll break the manure spreader. You know, they said, oh, we've met some great, crazy, wild kids, but it just got to be too much work.
Children of the corn, indeed. Kim Severson, thanks so much for the story. She's a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And now, fresh from the newsroom, we have Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. The UN Security Council is expected to hold an emergency meeting later today, after North Korea claimed it carried out an underground nuclear test. North Korea says that the latest nuclear test was more powerful than the one it claimed to have conducted in October 2006. President Obama has condemned the test, saying it was a threat to peace and warranted action by the international community. And the president spends the morning commemorating Memorial Day. He'll place a wreath on the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery. The president's top military adviser said on Sunday that the military faces enough challenges with two wars abroad and shouldn't rush to overturn the don't ask, don't tell law. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, told ABC's This Week that he wants to give the president the best advice he can on changing the rule.
My goal would be to achieve an objective assessment of the impact, if any, of this kind of change.
Mullen said that the president had made it clear that he will at some point ask Congress to change the don't ask, don't tell rule, but until then, the Pentagon plans to follow the existing ones. And in international news, in France, the Church of Scientology heads to trial today on fraud charges. Prosecutors say the church pushes people to give money using mental manipulation and scientifically unsound clues. That's looking at news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
There remains the question of detainees at Guantanamo who cannot be prosecuted, yet who pose a clear danger to the American people. And I have to be honest here, this is the toughest single issue that we will face.
That's the president talking about the 240 detainees held at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. But we haven't heard much about 600 detainees held at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. We're here with Rich Oppel, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He's got an article in today's paper telling the story of an Afghan detainee at Bagram who claims to be innocent and a U.S. military captain who believes him. Now, Rich, who are the men at Bagram in general?
In general, I mean, it's hard to get precise information out of the military on this, but they're believed to be almost all Afghans, but there are some from other countries, and there are about 600 of them. The Afghans, I would presume, I don't know for certain, but I mean, I would presume they are all mostly believed to be, or the people that the military claims or believes to be Taliban or Qaeda. And the same, I would imagine, is true for the foreign detainees that they've brought to Bagram.
So take us through your story in today's paper, narrowing down on this individual and the U.S. military captain. Who is this detainee?
He's from a province called Ghazni, which is a poor province southwest of Kabul. You know, according to the local police chief, local district governor, and village elders, he's just a nomadic shepherd, a member of a fairly well-known family down there, a tribe down there, who was scooped up by the Americans in September. The Americans apparently believe he's a Taliban leader named Qari Idris, although what the local Afghan officials in his home district say is that these are two different people, and the Americans picked up the wrong guy.
There is the captain, Captain Black, who has spoken out, Kirk Black, believing that the detainee is really this person who's a shepherd. Who is he, and what happened to him when he started raising questions?
He's a National Guard, an Army National Guard officer, who's already done a deployment at Guantanamo Bay a few years ago. So he's got some experience with detainee issues. But, you know, what he's done here, it's not so much that he's really sort of taken up the cause of this guy so much as he, you know, what he does in Afghanistan is train the police in this in one part of this this province I mentioned. And this family came to him and said, look, our relative has been imprisoned. They've got the wrong guy. He's innocent. And the captain listened to what his counterparts, his Afghan counterparts, the Afghan officials that he works with as part of his job, the local police chief, the local sub-governor, district sub-governor. And what he heard from all these guys was, look, this is a case of mistaken identity. And I think to the captain, it's, you know, he was ordered not to talk about this at one point once I had started discussing the case with him. So he had to be very careful, and he was very careful to limit what he said after that point. But it's clear, though, that what the captain saw in this was, you know, the most critical issue for him was not the ultimate guilt or innocence of this guy, but that the more critical issue in his view was, as Americans, you know, the military has to demonstrate that when Afghan officials, you know, their counterparts down there, come to them with cases of, you know, serious complaints of wrongful incarceration or other serious concerns, you know, the Americans just can't simply brush them off. I mean, they need to be responsive. They need to try to take steps to build some trust with the Afghans. That's all part of, you know, counterinsurgency doctrine. I mean, that's an important part of what their mission is.
Well, Rich, I want to just drill down a little bit more on Captain Black, because he was given a direct order to be silent, essentially, on this topic and not talk a lot about it. And he's actually under investigation. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where that stands or where that's going to go. When I inquired about this with the military, I could not get anything out of them. But there was, that's right, an investigating officer actually showed up at the base. And then everyone learned that the higher-ups had ordered an investigation of the captain, as the guy showed up to, you know, to take statements from officers there about what they knew about what had transpired.
What, if anything, do you know about what we can expect from the Obama administration as it frames the issue of the detainees in Afghanistan, not just the ones in Iraq?
Well, they've taken, on Afghanistan, they've taken the same line that the Bush administration has. I mean, they've argued in these lawsuits that there's no right of habeas corpus for detainees held at Bagram. And I think it remains to be seen ultimately what the Obama administration is going to do. There's some speculation that really what he's doing is keeping his options open right now and might drill down on it and make a, you know, refine his position later on. But I tried to talk to them about the story a little bit, and it's not something I could get comment from them on.
Right.
But I think there's certainly more to come on that.
And thanks so much. We've been talking with Rich Oppel, New York Times reporter, and now we are going to talk with Femi Okeh. Hi.
Hello there, 23 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. The UN Security Council is expected to hold an emergency meeting later today after North Korea claimed that it carried out an underground nuclear test. Last month, North Korea pulled out of the six-party talks on its nuclear program. President Obama condemned the test, saying it was a threat to peace and warranted action by the international community. The president will spend the morning commemorating Memorial Day. He'll lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns and give a speech in a few hours. This weekend, the president also gave some insight into who he will nominate to replace Justice Souter on the Supreme Court. President Obama spoke on C-SPAN.
What I want is not just ivory tower learning. I want somebody who has the intellectual firepower, but also a little bit of a common touch and has a practical sense of how the world works.
The president has interviewed at least two candidates for the High Court, and those involved in the decision say he could announce his pick as early as tomorrow. In sports, Elio Castroneves took home his third Indy 500 win on Sunday. Castroneves said that he had a few technical problems during the race.
We had a little issue with the radio and the gearbox, but nothing that would stop us to finish in the position that we finished.
Now, the victory came just 2 days after a jury threw out the last charges he faced in a federal tax evasion trial, which could have sent him to prison for 6 years. Turning to some international news. Those are the sounds of protesters in India, where riots broke out in the Indian state of Punjab after a violent dispute at a Sikh temple in Austria left a guru dead and several other Sikhs injured. Thousands of Sikh protesters took to the streets of Jalandhar, clashing with police and setting fire to vehicles and a train, and also damaging government buildings. A curfew has been imposed in the city and the Indian army has been deployed. And finally, the Cannes Film Festival wrapped up last night by awarding the festival's top award to the Austrian movie The White Ribbon. Now, it's filmed in black and white and also filmed in German. It's the story of the strange behaviour of a German village just before the start of World War I. Charlotte Gainsbourg won the Best Actress Award, and Best Actor Award went to Christopher Waltz for his performance in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. That's a look at your news for now.
Spicy, thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Farai Chidea. For the past 9 days, people have taken some very, very intriguing approaches to what can be done to honor America's fallen military members. It's Memorial Day, of course, but volunteers at Riverside National Cemetery in California have been reading the names of 148,000 fallen soldiers and vets that are interred at the cemetery. It's an unbroken roll call with volunteers reading day and night. One of them is Gwendolyn Goodlett. She is a retired computer operator for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and she's also a widow of the Vietnam War veteran. She was one of 500 volunteers who read names at the cemetery, and she's with us. Good morning, Gwendolyn.
Good morning.
So why'd you decide to take part in the reading? And tell us a little bit about your husband and his service.
My husband, he retired as a sergeant first class from the U.S. Army. He retired over in Germany. We were stationed in Germany at the time that he retired. And we stayed over there. He worked for the Army as a club manager, and then he was a PX manager. And, of course, at that time I was working for the Army, for the Corps of Engineers. And we just stayed over there in Germany for 23 years.
And I understand you were married for 42 years.
We were married 42 years,
and,
yes.
And you read his name.
They let us all of the readers were given a chance to dedicate to a family member or a friend, whoever we wanted to, before we started reading the names. And I dedicated his name the first time. The second time I dedicated a Efren Rivera for a very dear friend of mine.
Well, and when you did this reading, who were you with? What kind of people came out as you were doing this long vigil?
Well, my first partner was Mr. Salazar. He was the first partner, a very nice gentleman. And he had been in Vietnam during the time that my husband was there, but they never met. They were both in Vietnam during 67, 68, 69. And the rest of the people that I met were all wonderful people. We all had the same feeling. You could look in the eyes and tell that we all were there for the same purpose. And like my feelings were, I was very proud and sad to be one of the 500 volunteers participating in the roll call.
Was there anyone there who was speaking up for someone who was killed in the line of duty, say in Iraq?
Well, no, we didn't discuss that. Mr. Farah said he had many friends, and like my husband had many friends, and I do know he lost a lot of his friends over there, but that was not discussed.
Do you think people take the memorial in Memorial Day seriously now?
Some people. Quite a few, especially the family members. And then the different organizations are out there trying to remember the fallen ones. And
right.
I can't speak for everybody, but the majority of the people are honoring the military.
Well, I want to thank you so much. And we have been speaking with Gwendolyn Goodlett, who is a retired computer operator for the Army Corps of Engineers. Her husband, who was passed on, was a Vietnam veteran, and she was part of a long vigil to honor 148,000 fallen soldiers.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this morning we have been talking about non-traditional internships. It made us wonder, what was your best or worst time on that formative learning experience? Well, Michael from Michigan recalls an internship with an organization based in D.C., and his trouble wasn't with the internship, but where he lived.
And the group house that I stumbled into, the carpeting had fleas as well as the mattress that I was loaning. So each night as I was going to sleep, I would have to pick the fleas off my body as they jumped onto me.
Anemia as a side effect of interning. What happened to you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And now we've got Femi Okay with the headlines. Hey.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Condemnations are coming in this morning for North Korea's nuclear weapons test announcement. From America to the United Nations to China, governments are strongly critical of Pyongyang's announcement. North Korea's immediate neighbors, Japan, reacted to the nuclear tests with some alarm. Japan said the government was setting up a task force. Yasuhisa Kawamura is a spokesman for the Japanese government.
This is a challenge of the non-proliferation treaty regime of the international society. And it would also pose a serious challenge, a threat to the peace and stability of the region and as well as the international community.
There's expected to be a United Nations Security Council emergency meeting today to discuss possible new sanctions. The test hasn't been confirmed, but seismic reports from the area seem to indicate that it actually happened. President Obama will lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery later today. He'll also give a speech. He started Memorial Day hosting a breakfast with Gold Star families, those whose loved ones died in military service. Florida's governor says the Daytona Beach region is a disaster area. Days of rain have left waist-deep water and tens of millions of dollars in damage. The governor wants President Obama to declare a federal disaster so the area can get some more cleanup money. Volusia County spokeswoman Michelle Coates says the damage is widespread.
We have about 976
structures, mostly residential, some commercial, mobile homes, single-family homes that have been affected.
And many residents are now living in shelters. In sports, the Orlando Magic took a 2-1 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Final. Orlando won 99-89 last night. And tonight, the Denver Nuggets host the LA Lakers. Los Angeles leads the Western Conference Final 2-1. And finally, the voice that launched tens of millions of YouTube streams is back. Oh, filling up, getting quite emotional. That's Susan Boyle, the middle-aged woman who became a web sensation when she blew the crowd away on a popular British talent show. She's now into the finals and sings again next Saturday, and we'll find out if Susan Boyle will eventually triumph. That is a look at your news for now. Have a great morning and happy Memorial Day, all.
Makes me want to be a furry and dress up with a long tail. Just kidding.
I was going to say.
Benny.
Oh, a cat. Right, you are so weird.
It made me want to put on a glittery dress and sing. Hey, what are you going to be doing at 3 p.m. today, Farai?
Hopefully chilling at a barbecue.
Well, I've got another idea for you. The White House Commission on Remembrance is asking that every American pause for a moment to recall the sacrifice of fallen soldiers. It's just one effort to reclaim Memorial Day from its other status as the kickoff for summer. That struggle's been going on for a while. And joining us to talk about the origins of Memorial Day and how the meaning has morphed over the decades is Carolyn Janey. She is a professor of history at Purdue University, and she joins us from Luray, Virginia. Okay, Professor Janey, let's start by talking about the actual origin of Memorial Day.
Sure. There's a great deal of debate about the day's origins. Different groups, different ladies groups, I should mention, in the South have all claimed responsibility for that day, everywhere from Charleston, South Carolina, to Petersburg, Virginia.
And isn't there an argument about whether it was an effort to honor Confederate soldiers or Union soldiers?
Well, there seems to be little debate about that, because the first efforts were actually by Confederate women to honor Confederate soldiers beginning in 1866.
No, that's funny, because I actually had read that it was Union women who were trying to honor Confederate soldiers. So, but get back to this political nature of the first Memorial Day.
Sure. In the year after the Civil War ended, so the war ends in April of 1865. During that year afterwards, the Union Burial Corps, the United States Army, is burying their dead throughout the South, where most of the soldiers who fought in the Civil War had been killed. But there's no Confederate agency, there's no state agency in the South to do this type of work. So women's organizations throughout the South organized throughout 1865 to bury their dead, to create Confederate cemeteries that are essentially national Confederate cemeteries, just like you have national Union cemeteries at Arlington and at Gettysburg. And so these women, not only do they want to provide centralized resting places for their fallen Confederate soldiers, they also hope to establish an annual tradition of placing flowers and evergreens on the graves in remembrance for their lost cause, for their defeated cause. And so in the spring of 1866, throughout the South, these ladies' organizations pick different days that are symbolic for the local region. Some places choose May 10th. That was the day General Stonewall Jackson had died. Others choose April 26th. That's the day that General Johnston finally surrenders in 1865. And on those days, the communities would gather together. They would all proceed to the cemetery together. The women and children would lay flowers and evergreens on the graves. And former Confederate generals and former Confederate officers, or leaders rather, would offer some sort of speech about the Confederate soldiers. So they're very much a political response to Confederate defeat. They're a way of honoring their Confederate dead and claiming that they were honorable.
At what point did the different Memorial Day traditions coalesce into one?
Well, they don't really ever do so in the South. In the South, people still, communities still celebrate separate Confederate Memorial Days. Petersburg, Virginia, for example, will still celebrate June 9th as their day. But by the time we get to the 1880s, 1890s, former Confederate veterans and Union veterans are gathering together to celebrate Memorial Day, at least the National Memorial Day. As I said, that was created or first established by the Union Veterans Organization and incidentally by men rather than women, as had been the case in the South, in the spring of 1868. So we have May 30th that's established in 1868 where Union soldiers are remembered, and then Confederates will start to join in these celebrations by the 1880s.
Well, despite whatever conflict over this day and how it was celebrated and who celebrated it, it does seem that veterans, no matter what side you're on, were able to unite over the fact that they saw this day of remembrance slowly morph into a day of barbecue and parties.
Well, that's true. And by the 1890s, at least, and probably earlier, but I found direct evidence in the 1890s, veterans are very upset that people are not taking the day serious, that they're not using it as a day to remember the dead. I found an order issued by the Union Veterans Organization, the Grand Army, in 1894 to ministers throughout the country, asking them to read this message to their congregations on the Sunday before Memorial Day, and requesting that May 30th be set apart to commemorate the memory of departed heroes. And it requested that the ministers discourage church and Sunday school excursions, picnics, which is obviously what we tend to do today, mm-hmm. or other frivolous amusements on the occasion, and ask them instead to honor the men who had served their country.
Just very quickly, because wars are often incredibly controversial, do you think that may have taken some of the shine off of Memorial Day as a serious holiday, particularly the Afghanistan and Iraq wars have been racked by controversy?
Are you asking whether I think that means that we don't celebrate picnics?
Yeah, is there any evidence that the controversies of recent wars, all the way back to Vietnam, have changed the nature of Memorial Day?
Sure. I think any time that we're at war, we're more likely to pay attention and remember the dead. It seems particularly significant that it's in 1971, during the Vietnam War, that Memorial Day is finally declared a national holiday by an act of Congress.
Carolyn Janney, we have to let it go there. Thank you so much for joining us. She's an assistant professor of history at Purdue University, joining us from Luray, Virginia.
And we are talking this morning about non-traditional internships. Some folks are going to farms. One listener, Bob from North Jersey, says it's a trend that's been around for a while.
Back in the 1950s, I was involved as part of Newtown Agricultural High School in New York, an intern program going out on farms at ages 14 and 15. And some of us are still friends after all these years.
Yeah, it sounds pretty beautiful. Tell us your story at thetakeaway.org. And you can, of course, email us mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Oh, happy Memorial Day, everyone. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.